This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. Hi listeners, editing for our latest episode is taking way longer than expected, but we'll be ready for release on Monday. In the meantime, please enjoy this favourite of mine from our archive, which happens to be when Annie was my assistant host. Rest assured, we're hard at work recording at Edinburgh Fringe Festival and have loads of new content on the way relating to that. This week, we're talking all things resilience as a factor in mental health. So to start off with, I've got a definition of resilience from the Cambridge English Dictionary. They said it's the ability to be happy, successful, etc. again after something difficult or bad has happened. And in the episode, we talk at length about how resilience can be so important as something to build on and as something to learn to get through times of mental illness, and also contrast how closely that can link with physical illness, how we can be active in our recovery, whether it's physical or mental illness. So, Annie, any initial thoughts on this theme?
I've been really struck this week by how much resilience is a learned skill. I work a lot with kids in the week, and I speak to them quite a lot about life and do a lot of mental health support with them in general. And I forget how resilient I am as a result of things that have happened to me throughout my life. And it almost feels like watching a child like try to use a spoon. You know, you just take for granted that you already know how to do that. But I listen to these teenagers talk sometimes about their mental health problems or their self-esteem problems or their bullying problems. And I forget that resilience is not something that we're just granted at birth. I think it's very much something that we have to learn. And it's very much something that comes with practice and with age, unfortunately. But I've been particularly struck by that this week, and I've been really looking forward to raising that on the podcast because I think it's so important.
Right, absolutely. Obviously, the main focus for us is how this is a factor in mental health, but really it's a factor in life. It's so broad. And so, like you say, whether it's bullying, whether it's mental health, whether it's physical health, in the episode, we talk quite a lot about how important resilience is when you have what our guest describes as life shocks. So these kind of setbacks or unexpected changes in your life, and how much faster you can recover from them and sort of bounce back, as it were, with them. And sometimes you have unexpected changes or bad news where it's not possible to have an end solution of. There's no fixing some things, but actually resilience is as much about recovery as it is about learning to better manage and cope with the unexpected things life can throw at us.
Agreed, for sure. Absolutely.
In the episode, we talked to Sophie Savage, who's a fantastic writer, and a lot of her writing centers around cancer, which is something she's dealing with. So she's really incredibly insightful. And it was an absolute joy to learn from her, really, because I found myself falling into a sort of trap with talking about cancer where I realized I'm relying on a lot of the stereotypical things that people say. So I learned a lot how to not rely on the stereotypes, how to not rely on the things that everyone says, and be a bit more kind of real, because everyone wants to be sympathetic towards cancer, and actually sometimes, and there's nothing wrong with that, but sometimes all someone that's dealing with it wants is just to be seen as them and not their illness.
They don't want to be defined by it. I think speaking to everyone that I know that's lived through cancer, they say one of the overwhelming things they say is that they are not cancer. They are not the illness. The illness is within them, but it doesn't define who they are.
That fine balance of work to understand what the person's going through whilst not letting it define your view of them. And that's something that, that parallels quite closely with mental health. I'm many things, but I'm nobody's depressed friend.
Like, yeah, for sure.
That's never, I'm never going to allow that be my overarching adjective.
Absolutely.
I learned a lot in terms of trying to shed some of the stereotypes maybe I had about cancer and what is and isn't helpful to say, and actually how much mental and physical health interacts with such a long-term and life-changing condition like that. So I think it's been a really fascinating episode from that point of view, of really drilling down to how much closer mental health and physical health really are to each other. We'll get into that in a moment. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, nothing at all. I'm just super sad I didn't get to experience it firsthand, but I was educating the bright young minds of tomorrow. So, sorry about that.
Important work. Well, I'm sure you'll enjoy listening to it. So,
thank you.
We'll get into that episode in just a moment. But first,
this week's Audible recommendation.
This week, I'm recommending The Cancer Whisperer by our guest, Sophie Savage. This book does not offer a cure for cancer. It offers a cure for your fear of cancer. Sophie's breakthrough book combines practical advice with a new approach that turns traditional attitudes to cancer on their head. To listen to your first book free with Audible, go to our link at bit.ly/mentalbooks.
Let me start with when I was younger, and what really got me into the whole territory of mental health, emotional health, psychological health. In many ways, I had quite a privileged upbringing, childhood, but having a privileged upbringing doesn't make you exempt from trauma, or self-doubt, or heavy self-criticism. And I actually physically developed very, very young. So by the time I was 10 years old, I was 5'6". I was the height I am now. Mm-hmm. At the age of 10. I was a fully developed woman, menstruating. It was extremely difficult for me to deal with. I wasn't ready for it at all. And by the time I was 16, I had eating disorders. Because I thought there was something wrong with my body. I thought I was ugly. I thought, you know, I shouldn't be a woman. Mm-hmm. I was just very, very, very unhappy in my own skin and laughed at on the athletics when I was running. And it was just a kind of very humiliating period of my life. So by the time I was 16, I was bulimic. And I really that continued on and off into my early 20s. And beyond, probably maybe, I don't know, 7-8 years, I guess it happened. And that's what really got me into, I remember graduating from university and I'd written a dissertation about mad women in literature and women writers who, like the mad woman in the attic in Jane Eyre, and but also women authors who wrote their way out of madness. And that was my whole dissertation was about that. And I got a first class degree, but I also, by the end of that, was severely ill with my eating disorder. And there was this incongruence between my intellectual understanding of what it meant to be a powerful, unique, authentic woman and how I was actually behaving. And that's when I went into therapy. That's when I went, I need help now. And I got into therapy when I was, I guess, 21 years old, something like that. And in some ways, I've been in therapy on and off ever since. I explored a lot of psychological work, spiritual work. I did it really lock, stock, and barrel full of crystals. I mean, I really explored the territory, and some of it was of no use to me at all, and some of it was incredibly useful.
Right. And so in terms of your early experience there from going through puberty younger than your peers and how all these changes to your body happen so fast, to what extent do you think that was a factor in developing the bulimia?
I think that's a really good question. because I used to believe it was because my body developed too early that I became ill, that I made myself ill. That's not true. My body developed early, but I judged that as wrong. And I judged that as not okay. And I judged my body as ugly and unlovable and that it shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't look like this. And I was growing up in a context, it was incredible pressure in the context I grew up in to be petite and pretty and get a husband. I went to a boarding school and the ambitions of most of my friends wasn't to have a career, but to have a husband and a Volvo and babies, and which was actually of no interest to me even then. And so I saw myself as weird. All of that was going through my head. So it's the judgments and the criticism and the beliefs that I put in place that created the bulimia. It wasn't my body that did that to me. It's what I made it mean. And when I discovered that, I went, oh, now I know how to get out of this. Because I can't change my body, but I can change what I think about it. And that was groundbreaking for me to discover the power of what was going through my own head.
Right. I think that's such an important distinction of how it's very easy to have this simplistic cause and effect, but actually so much of it is within our locus of control, is due to the kind of thoughts we have. When you were talking about that, I could really understand how, as a young woman, you're still figuring out your body, you're going through all these changes, and so it might make sense that I'm growing up too fast, I'm bigger than the other girls. Oh, here's a way for me not to be bigger than the other girls.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite psychological in that sense. You know, psychologic it was, but it was, I wasn't even overweight. I was a perfectly healthy weight for my height. But compared to my peers, I decided there was something very, very wrong with me and that I had to be thin to be okay.
Yeah. And I can understand in the context of the school and the kind of pressures that were on you in terms of what your life should be, how so much of that was put on the physical, you know, as opposed to potentially the skills you'd need for the career, because it wasn't as career focused.
Exactly.
Perhaps this is to a large extent my gender, but my education experience was really opposite, where there was so much pressure on my academia. And I have dyslexia, so that was always an uphill battle.
And yeah, then, I can imagine.
But then actually it was a lot of the, particularly at university level, it was a lot more on the mental health side and a lot more on how I was personally coping rather than the academia, where I really needed the support.
Yeah, I was very happy in academia. I felt confident there, and you know, I couldn't wait to write my next English essay. And that's where I liked myself. So I loved my mind and I hated my body. I loved my brain and my intelligence. And that's, in a way, I attached my self-esteem to being clever. So even that became problematic after a while, because I attached my self-esteem to it rather than I simply appreciated my own intelligence. It became, I'm worth something because I'm clever. And that has a limited shelf life, because no one's worthy for that reason, really. It took me a long time to just get, I'm okay as I am, and I have nothing to prove, and I don't need to be clever or thin or unique or special to be okay. It took me a long time.
And that's such a good point, because really, whatever it is you attach your worth to, if it's something specific, there's always going to be someone that's better at that and worse at that. But actually, what really sets us apart is our individuality, the way that you do something and how that's different to someone else, not your IQ or anything finite.
Exactly. So well said. I work with what I call life shocks. Life shocks are those moments, are just unexpected moments in time, external events, curveballs that come at us. And I've learned that they are harbingers of reality. So when we attach our self-worth to something, then we get life shocks that expose that. If you're trying to prove you're clever, something's going to come along to show that you're not as clever as everybody else, but will you still value yourself anyway? I mean, when I got brain tumors, I mean, I'm fast forwarding right now. I'm living with incurable cancer, and I've had multiple brain tumors 3 times. And the brain tumors, when they come, they threaten my mental agility, my cognitive powers, my eyesight. At one point, I was struggling to form sentences coherently. I'm a writer, and I'm struggling to form coherent sentences. So the brain tumors have repeatedly threatened what I've most attached my self-worth to, my eloquence, my intelligence, even my sense of Sophie. It's threatened Sophie. I said to my husband once, when I'm not Sophie anymore, put me down. Just put me down. That was hard. But it also really showed me, what if I'm still worth something if I can't speak? What if I'm still worth something if I can't write a sentence? Am I still worth something if I can't walk, or I can't see, or I can't? It was very, very challenging for me to go. I mean, I had strong self-worth at that point, but it took me to another layer of who am I, and am I still worthy if all this is stripped away from me? That was an incredible encounter with how much do you really value yourself.
Right. And that really reminds me of what you were saying about university, how you had these ideas in your head and with what you were studying of what it was to be strong and what it was to be a powerful woman. And yet it's one thing to think it and a very different thing to live it.
Like, so different.
And I think that's one of the really difficult things that you've described there, is that you appreciate the value in every person, and you had all this self-esteem that you built up over time, but that doesn't mean you don't set high standards for yourself, and that you, in really identifying with your writing and that being a big part of your purpose, it's such a threat to you that that could be taken away.
Yeah, very threatening. And yet therein is the kind of secret of resilience, in a way, because I think layer by layer by layer, the more we peel away and confront and dispense with our false beliefs, because most of these beliefs, I'm unworthy, I'm unlovable, I'm ugly, they're not true. None of them are true. Very little of what we really believe is true. We act as if these things are true, but then when you realize they're not true and you can shed the lies that we tell ourselves and shed the next lie and the next lie. I used to think once I shed the lies, I'll just be okay and I won't get any more shocks. Mm. But that's not true. There's just layer upon layer upon layer. And with every lie you shed, the greater your inner resilience becomes, because it feeds off your authenticity and your self-regard. You know, resilience literally thrives off self-regard, in my experience. The more we can build that in ourselves, the more resilient we can be, even when life is throwing brain tumors at us or really traumatic things.
For sure. And that's one of the reasons why I thought you were such an ideal person for this topic, because whilst what you're going through with your tumors is luckily more extreme than the vast majority of people do experience when it comes to their health, it's still something where the important takeaway with resilience is how you build it, almost like a muscle. There's a motivational speaker I really love called Lisa Nichols, and she talks about these different muscles, like your resilience muscle. And so it's not the absence of life shocks or any kind of trauma you go through. It's just how you deal with it. And actually, when you break it all down, that's the only thing you have control of.
Precisely. Because, in fact, it's not even the... I think it's the very presence of life shocks builds your resilience, actually. Mm-hmm. The bigger the hits, the more resilience is available to you. I mean, you find out what you're made of. I mean, I think Maya Angelou said it so beautifully. She said something like, we cannot control what happens to us, but we can choose not to be diminished by it.
Right.
I love that. And in a way, the last 4 years of my life have been the most brutal of my life. I've nearly died twice. I'm raising a child I'm likely to not see into adulthood. It's been brutal and heartbreaking for me. It's heartbreaking. And yet, I'm more myself than I've ever been. And I have more faith than I've ever had.
Yeah.
And I've been more creative and productive and purposeful than I was before. There's a strength I have found in response to all of this that I don't really even know where it comes from. I don't even want to call it mine. Some of it might be mine, but some of it just seems to come through me when I need it. So it's been a very, very testing few years. And I don't think finding resilience, it's like it wasn't a conscious thing. It was like, this is what life has thrown at me. So how am I going to show up?
Right.
How am I going to respond to this? You know, I was riddled with tumors when I was diagnosed. I mean, they literally couldn't count the tumors in my body. I had them in my spine, my brain, my lungs, my lymph nodes. And they gave me 4 months to live. And that was the most terrifying, heartbreaking experience of my life. And it tested everything I've been teaching for 20 years. Like, really? Now are you going to trust the life shocks? Now are you going to handle your fear? Really? I mean, the rubber hit the road in terms of my integrity, actually. But I feel so profoundly empowered by it.
Yeah.
And it's likely to take me out still. But I'm going to go out myself rather than, I'm not going out victimized or terrified or angry or bitter or resentful. And I'm proud of that.
Yeah, that's so wonderful. And what I was thinking of as you said that is how you've talked about all this understanding of resilience, but then it actually came to the point where you had to rely on yourself more than you ever had before. And then that took you to a place where you could see it far more clearly and see who you were and what you are when you boil down to it, when your back's against the wall, how strong you really can be.
Precisely. And I think the thing that's really come home to me is, I think when I was younger, I thought resilience was about being tough or being in control or toughing things out. It's the opposite. You pluck it from the center of your vulnerability. In your most vulnerable moments, that's where you find it. It's like you can rise to your destiny when you're brought to your knees. Those are the moments. And very often it's when we're brought to our knees that we rise into who we really, really are. So resilience is birthed by vulnerability, might be a better way of saying that. Nothing to do with being tough at all. In fact, that's the opposite of resilience. That's defensiveness.
Right. Because I think that's quite a common misconception that people think those that they look at and consider resilient don't feel things, don't have hardships, they get through everything, they don't even feel it. But actually it's by really feeling it and surviving despite that, that's where true resilience is.
And being willing to cry and I mean, to not feel your pain and your fear and your grief is to shut down. There's nothing resilient about that. That's just numbing out and putting on an armor, a false armory. That's fake. It's not real. I gave a tribute to my dad this year, just a few weeks ago, at his memorial service, and I didn't read it. I just spoke. There were a few times that I cried as I spoke, and I was fine with that. I had my feelings. My feelings did not have me. I had them, and I was completely okay in myself. There were 500-600 people there, and a number of people came up to me and said, "That must have been very, very difficult for you." And they call it break. Someone called it, "You nearly broke down." And I said, no, I wasn't breaking down. I was coming together. Mm. I was nowhere near. But you see it in the news. Someone cries on television and it's they broke down because they're crying. It's bollocks. Sorry. It's bollocks to say someone crying means they're breaking down. It means they're being a human being.
Yeah.
It's being human. And it's such an unhelpful way to talk about people feeling their pain. It's so unhelpful.
It really is. It really holds people back. It paints feeling negative emotions as a flaw. It goes to that same thing of people thinking you have to be tough and you have to bury this. And that's pretty universal, whether it's in this sort of man up nonsense or if it's the British stiff upper lip. You know, there's so much of that sewn into our culture. And yeah, it's madness to think of what the opposite would be like. So if people said, oh, they broke down because they smiled, like, oh, they've got no composure because they smiled on TV, it'd be laughable.
To hide the suffering, to paint a mask over it, that's much closer to a breakdown in my eyes than to show your pain. I'll tell you a story. When I wrote this, I included this story in my first book. It's really the reason I wrote my first book, The Cancer Whisperer. And I was sitting in a waiting room in a hospital. I think I was waiting for radiotherapy to my spine. And it was so British. You know, eyes were down, upper lips were stiff. We were all there for the same reason. No one was talking to each other. No one was saying, are you as scared as me? How are you doing? Why are you here? It was silence. And I could feel the fear stalking the corridors. And it like hung over the waiting room like a fog. And I got this text from a friend of mine. I can't remember what it said, but it moved me. And I start crying. So I'm sitting in the waiting room crying. And I'm good with that. And by the way, I've just been told I'm going to die. So I'm crying. And the nurse came running over to me, full of anxiety. I could feel her own anxiety. So, are you okay? You okay? You okay? Like this. She just dumped her anxiety on my lap. And the subtext was, stop crying. It's not okay to cry here. Stop crying. Like, it was not okay to be crying. Are you okay? You okay? She wanted me to stop crying, as if it was like a disease, contagious disease that would spread around.
Well, yes,
the room.
If you cry, then like they that. All might cry.
They all might cry. Then what are we going to do? And I looked at her and I looked around the room and I said, do you know what? I think I might be the only person here who is okay. Because what could be more appropriate when I've just been told I'm going to die and not raise my daughter? I think that's emotionally congruent. Mm-hmm. To be sitting here with some tears running down my face. How come no one else is crying?
Right.
And that's why I wrote my book. I started blogging, actually. I thought I need to give people permission to talk about cancer and talk about fear and talk about the terror and talk about how do we navigate the psychological challenges of a cancer diagnosis? How do we take hold of our fear so our fear doesn't take hold of us? Because when I watch it with many cancer patients I'm in touch with, the fear runs the show and it makes the decisions and it obeys the doctors and it does what they tell you. And And there's nothing, there's no one saying, when I was, for me, there was no one offering me psychological support. No one asked me how I felt. Nobody sent me to counseling. It was just, this is what to expect from chemotherapy, and this is how to apply for Blue Badge parking. And I'm like, hang on a minute. I'm a human being. But I'm being treated like a patient, not a human being. I mean, this is the cancer world, but it was an amazing experience to me of it not being okay to cry in the most appropriate situation for tears to roll.
Right. It's incredible. And it's reminding me of a strange irony in the medical world that the people that weren't crying, it was likely for a number of reasons, but I'm sure for some of them it would be shock that what's going on hasn't sunk in, and they're just slightly zombified by that.
Whereas they numb out.
Yes, whereas you're really feeling the emotions and you're working through it, and yet the same doctors that would see that as a problem and try and get you to stop crying are the same ones that would say, oh, they're in shock, and diagnose that in somebody else. So there's apparently no winning. And they're both stages of working through the grief and coming to terms with everything.
That's so well said. I even discovered, you've probably heard of the placebo effect.
Right, yeah.
But there's also something called the nocebo effect, where they did a test with 500,000 patients who, in Sweden, I think it was, who were tested for cancer. And of those who tested positive, and not necessarily terminal, just positive, there was a 29.6-fold increase in heart-related death within 1 week.
Wow.
That, which means people are dying of shock, literally dying of shock.
Yeah.
And that's tragic and completely unnecessary for people to be dying of shock. And I'm very confident that the tools I had to work through my terror and the support I had in my life to, I just remember it now, to uphold me through my terror is one of the reasons I'm still alive. Because I watched myself dying of shock. I was watching myself going, I said to my husband, I'm dying of shock. Because I wasn't dying till they told me I was going to die. And the moment that was in my head, I started dying.
Yeah.
It was rapid. And I said to him, I need to get the belief that I'm going to die out of my head. I need to attend to my mind as much as my body, or I'm a goner. Mm. I was so clear about that. But I was fortunate to have incredibly powerful tools in my hand and support in my life to do that work. And many, many people don't have that.
Right.
And thus they die of shock. And it's tragic.
It's so incredible that you had that level of insight as well, because I think that's something that still is very little understood, the link between the narratives we tell ourselves in our head and how that affects our physical world. Because if you are convinced you're going to die and that's what you're focused on, you're going to look out at the world and find ways to justify it. You're going to look at your physical symptoms, or you're going to look at the doctor's charts and be like, look, I'm right. And it reinforces that same thing. And if you're not careful, you end up proving yourself right.
It is so true that, I mean, I did a lot of research, but I always say to patients, just one thing you must not look at is statistics, because once they're in your head, it's really hard to get them out. But I've also seen patients, they're given a sell-by date, a use-by date, you're going to die by. I mean, who wants their use-by date, for God's sake? But once the use-by date is in their head, it's in their head and they live up to it. So I'm convinced that when you're given a year, some patients die a year later because that's the date they've been given. It becomes, like you say, now obviously there's some reality to, I mean, cancer is a killer disease, and I was in deep trouble deep trouble. And, I needed to treat my body as well as my mind. Let's keep this very real.
Yeah.
But there's a factor, and I think there's an emotional resilience that you need when your body is breaking down. That's for certain. There's emotional dis-ease underneath physical disease. Now, there are genetic factors. There are environmental factors. I asked myself, what are the emotional psychological roots of my cancer? I'm very sure that my bulimia was one of the causes of my cancer. I did a lot of damage to my body mm-hmm. and my colon and my gut. In Chinese medicine, they say that all disease begins in the gut. And I damaged my gut. And I worked with a naturopath who said, I'm not interested in where your tumors are. I had no tumors in my gut. And he said, if we can heal your gut, then you have a chance. You have a chance. And he started to work on healing my gut. It was an amazing thing. And I did a lot of work with that that was, very, very healing. It didn't necessarily mean it would save me. But it meant even if I'm going to die, I've healed something that needed healing before I went. And having lung cancer literally revealed and unlocked decades of grief I had never engaged with. So I'm really confident of connections between physical disease and emotional dis-ease.
Right. And there's one I would parallel with that I'm more familiar with. And that's when it comes to people, the way they can hold tension. If there's things yeah. we've not dealt with, we hold it in our body, often in our shoulders or our back. And then people go for a massage and often they end up in tears because it's not just the physical tension, it's whatever emotionally is contributing to that as well. It's both the physical and the emotional that's getting that release in the room.
Exactly, because if it doesn't come out, where's it going to go?
Right. And so, unfortunately, you need to wrap up shortly.
So interesting. Carry on.
I'm really keen to contrast in terms of things you've told me off air with several years ago, you were told that you had 4 months to live. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us, A, how many years ago that was? And B, you've had some really good scan results just now as well.
Yeah. Well, it was just over 4 years ago. I was given 4 months. I still have cancer as I speak to you, but it does not have me. That's my mantra. I have cancer. It does not have me. That was huge turning point for me in my mental approach to it. I've had multiple brain tumors 3 times in the last 4 years. I've had brain surgery. My brain is my weak spot. Anyway, I just had a brain scan yesterday and all is well, I'm happy to report. So right now, I'm almost tumor-free. I still have cancer in my blood. It can activate itself any time. But as I speak to you now, I feel like a normal person.
That's so brilliant. And I think that's a really good point because the cancer is still there, but I'm confident that you feeling like a normal person is to a huge extent about your mindset, because you could so easily think it's not gone, I'm still terminal, and really focus on that. But instead you're focusing on how you've been able to get through, how you've had all these emotional strengths, how you've been able to look after your mind and your body. And that's where your focus is and that's where your strength is.
I mean, it's a huge part of it. I think negative thinking is like painting black clouds onto a blue sky, and positive thinking is a bit like putting icing on dog shit, calling it a cake. We need to keep it real. You know what I mean? We do that, and it's another form of self-deception, actually. So I think my attitude is much more, I'm fully accepting of my situation. And I nearly died a year ago. I literally put my head on the pillow believing I was going to die that night. And I surrendered to it. And then I woke up. That stayed with me because I've surrendered to my mortality in a way that means I don't need to walk around terrified of it all the time. I don't need to do that. I haven't come to terms with leaving my daughter. That's the thing I haven't surrendered to. But I have surrendered to my mortality, and that makes, it doesn't stalk me. It doesn't stalk me. And we're all terminal, by the way. We're all terminal. So I'm not special in any sense. We can all get taken out at any moment. And I remember that too. And of course, I have my very dark days and my very dark nights, and I need to continually work through my fear when it comes, and my terror when it comes, and my grief when it comes. I think it's just an ongoing thing to engage with.
Right, absolutely. And I think that's really universal, what you've said there. Ultimately, we all have a shelf life. Unfortunately, there's only so long any of us can live. And so it is a lifelong battle to keep yourself as well as you can, as well as you feel able to.
I never call it a battle.
Okay.
And the battle with cancer and the fight against cancer, it's a really unhelpful metaphor that creates anxiety and stress and puts us at war with our bodies. Cancer is not an enemy, it's an illness. And it's one of the attitudes I'm trying to change in the cancer world is, let's stop calling this a battle and let's treat it as an illness and even a teacher, but not an enemy. And I feel quite passionate about that. So I just wanted to say that.
No, I really understand that, because I guess the nearest parallel I have is that I really don't like when people overuse struggling with mental illness as a term.
Yeah, I know.
It just makes me feel depressed to hear that.
Exactly. It's patronising.
I think it makes us sound a lot more passive. So I would generally refer to it as managing mental illness. Because we're a big part of that process, as opposed to struggling sounds like it's something happening to you rather than something happening in you.
I agree. And by the way, I work with generally the mentally well. I run courses for the mentally well, literally in inverted commas. But really, I've never met a person who's truly mentally well, who does not have insecurities, who does not have fear, who does not have... I mean, I know there are serious mental illnesses. I don't want to diminish that. But I've never really met someone who's 100% mentally well myself. And I've worked with thousands and thousands of people over the years, you know.
Absolutely. And even if you did, there's nothing to say that it can't still affect them anyway. No one's immune.
Exactly.
So we'll finish up now then with a little bit about your latest book that came out this year.
Sure. Yeah, my latest book, it's really my life's work, this book. It's called Life Shocks and How to Love Them. And it's a book about the work I teach, which is how do you bring your creative best to the traumas, curveballs, unexpected, blindsiding moments that come your way. And I'm not talking about the once in a while things. I mean, every single day we get life shocks. Every unexpected event in your day is a life shock. So some are big and some are small, and they all confront our false thinking. And this book is about, teaches people how to harness the transformative power of these experiences instead of being victimized by them. That's essentially what the book's about. And it covers a whole range of body image, sexual assault, addiction, grief, death, suicide. It covers a lot of different subjects. So it has breadth as well as depth. I'm very proud of it. And I've written it to make as big a difference as I can make to not just to people dealing with the day-to-day challenges and wondering how to thrive in the midst of it all.
Right. Great. And I'm so excited to read it. It sounds brilliant. And like you say, it's something that I'm sure will affect anyone. We all go through grief. We all at some point have to confront death. So it sounds brilliant, and I'm sure it will change so many lives.
I hope so.
So we'll round up there. So thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.